Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, we'll have earnings from the Home Shopping Network, Crocs, and CVS, as we've done a lot with the pharmacy industry of late. One note is that Leighton's going to be talking a lot more than myself this episode. As you might be able to tell, my voice isn't in the best of circumstances. But first, we want to talk to you about maybe a franchise opportunity that is in a much better circumstance than my voice, because you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time. But maybe you're just not sure where to start. All of this could potentially be yours, though, if you open a UPS store franchise.
That's right. The UPS store has over 35 years of franchising experience, and they were just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. They offer stability, the support, and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all of the training and marketing support you'll ever need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner? Maybe now. Visit the upsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's the upsstorefranchising.com/focus. Leading our show today is Walgreens is starting to mull over what it's doing with its new Rite Aid locations. CVS beats on earnings and shows strength in multiple areas, making some wonder if the retail pharmacy operator is still number one after all. And it wasn't just an earnings report, as CVS came out with an announcement that they're rolling out next day pharmaceutical shipping throughout the country and same day shipping in certain areas throughout the country by next year. The company, of course, is now labeled CVS Health, but we're going to condense it to CVS throughout this story. And Leighton, like with Walgreens, pharmacy becoming a bigger piece of the revenue pie here. We shot some emails back and forth with a listener who was talking about some of their initiatives. Pharmacy sales for Walgreens now around 72% of site revenue. And we see site revenue for pharmacy sales for CVS also going up.
Absolutely. And we'll dig into those numbers, but it certainly is an interesting dynamic, because if you look at the overall store footprint for an average store, you can see that the majority of the store is made up of those retail areas. We talk about toys, food and beverage, cosmetics is a big one, especially for Walgreens, a green area for Walgreens, in fact, where they saw increasing sales in that particular niche. However, it's the pharmacy area, the area that takes up the least amount of space, that drives the most amount of revenue. So you talk about interesting dynamics, that is certainly one. And it's something that's been talked about a lot in the media, at least as far as retail pharmacy is concerned, because a lot of operators are now leaning towards being able to deliver these pharmaceuticals over mail and then have an online or digital platform to then sort of have a backup plan if individuals can't come to those stores to pick up those prescriptions. And obviously, Amazon has been in the news as of late, and I think that's why some of these stories have gotten a little bit more coverage. We talk about CVS, Walgreens. Well, those companies are in the news only because of Amazon, I think, a little bit more so here as of late. Amazon really driving down stock prices in the pharmaceutical industry. A lot of people are worried about that future pricing pressure. But as it relates to CVS, those front-end sales did get pummeled, and analysts are blaming competition there. It's no secret that markups are higher on many of those retail goods that they carry. Again, toys, home goods, those are going to have a little bit higher margins. And because of that, a lot of people may just decide to pick up their prescriptions and that's it. Top line revenue for the third quarter hit around $46.2 billion for CVS versus the $46.17 expected. So they beat on top line revenue, and that was according to Thomson Reuters consensus estimates. Year over year, they had an increase of 3.5%. That front of the store revenue declined about 2.8% for the quarter, more or less in line with their competitors' performance. Total pharmacy revenues increased 8.1% overall, but this includes a lot of the deliveries outside of those physical stores that we were mentioning. Retail and what they call long-term care segment total same-store sales decreased 3.2%, slightly better still than expectations. And a lot of this, Trent, had to do with the hurricane damage, closing a lot of stores temporarily, and something we'll get into here, as the company did a really great and transparent job of going through exactly how they think it affected their business. Again, going to be a theme for the next quarter or so are those effects from Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Harvey. And we talk about the function of generic pricing. This actually caused same-store sales in the pharmacy sector to come down a little bit as well. And it's interesting because they're mentioning 30-day volume going up. So while they are shipping and delivering more prescriptions overall, they're seeing a little bit of pricing pressure. And that is a very interesting dynamic because you see a lot more generics coming on the market. However, overall, you are seeing more drugs coming on the market as companies are beginning to roll out some patents. Without one-time items, the company earned around $1.50 per share, outpacing Wall Street estimates of $1.48 per share. The $1.50 per share was at the high end of company guidance, so that's a positive if you're an executive. And the GAAP earnings per share of $1.26, pretty much in line with what others were expecting. Newer, exciting items that are showcasing the changing desires of their customer. And this is interesting, Trent, because you mentioned it at the top. Next day delivery from their stores in 2018. Again, this is what a lot of analysts are calling a direct response from all the rumors, all of the executives talking from Amazon about them trying to come in to the pharmaceutical segment. And if you look at the message from Chief Executive Larry Merlo, he said to analysts that we will bring the pharmacy to our patients' doorsteps. So I think this is more about the convenience aspect. And this is a company, CVS Health, that is always talking about being able to take care of their customers, wanting to create some sort of brand loyalty. And I think that's exactly what they're doing here. And you see that, again, Amazon has been transparent and the public interest, in the public eyes at least, about their domestic pharmacy business, trying to grow there, looking at the best avenues to attract customers. And it's interesting because here you're going to have a fight with those customers that are very loyal to Walgreens, Rite Aid, CVS. It is very interesting to see, in the future at least, whether or not Amazon is going to be able to pull those customers away once they already are familiarized with that particular ecosystem. As it pertains to the overall percent of revenue, Trent mentioned that 72% of Walgreens' revenue is now coming from pharmaceutical sales. And Trent, it looks as though those numbers are pretty much matched up well with CVS Health.
With CVS, you're looking at it making up about 70% of revenue. So CVS does get a slightly higher percentage of revenue derived from their front store sales, but it's very clear that CVS is de-emphasizing the front of store sales and emphasizing the pharmaceutical sales, since again, they have more control over markups and that type of thing. And they want to be sure they are positioned strongly there for when Amazon potentially rolls out the pharmaceutical services that they've been rumored to roll out. But as Leighton mentioned too, there's a lot of patents coming up that people have submitted or companies have submitted to the FDA. And I think as many generics as have been rolled out, and oftentimes CVS will talk about generics for Viagra in particular, maybe impacting their bottom line over the next couple of years, there are just as many drug companies that are patenting new drugs that CVS could take advantage of. I wanted to mention the hurricanes very quickly, as Leighton talked about some of the impact from the hurricanes that we're likely to see a lot of retail businesses discuss. Hurricanes, at least for CVS, caused 925 stores to be closed for different periods of time. When you look at where the CVS locations are situated in the United States, I think CVS potentially took a larger hit from the hurricanes than many other retail businesses, other than maybe regional retail businesses, businesses like Publix and HEB in the grocery sector. And in fact, 11 stores are still closed after impacts from the hurricane. CVS has a very large footprint in Florida. They also have a large footprint in Texas. So we're seeing that CVS obviously impacts from the hurricanes even still. $55 million in damages so far from the hurricanes. It doesn't seem like a lot because it isn't in the large scheme of things, but we should keep in mind here that the damages far exceeded $55 million, but CVS is only responsible for the deductibles. So a lot of this covered by insurance, and when you look at some of the deductible information on insurance plans for retail companies, we can extrapolate that certainly damages in the hundreds of millions here for CVS after the hurricanes. Plus, CVS has also donated $10 million plus in cash for local relief efforts. This will generate positive PR, and they might stow it away as essentially marketing funds when they do their bottom line. But it's also important with that $10 million spent to help those that may be current or future customers. So they see this more as an investment in their future. Speaking of their customers, they were able to text a lot of their customers with warnings and allow people to pick up medication before storms hit if they knew a location was going to be closed ahead of time. And this speaks to really meeting the customer where the customer is at. I think a lot of companies, particularly in the pharmacy sector, are struggling with trying to find ways to communicate with customers. And in my opinion, this is what sets Walgreens and CVS apart, is that they've really opened up communication with their customers from their pharmacy area. And I think a lot of us, just personally, when we go and pick up a prescription or deal with a pharmacy, we've probably experienced a breakdown in communication at some point in time. Either they don't have the doctor's refill loaded on the computer, or maybe they forgot to fill the prescription altogether. And with CVS, they're trying to decrease the amount of friction that takes place in that process. The more you're able to decrease that amount of friction, the more you're able to generate repeat business. And repeat business in the pharmacy industry is everything. And when we talk about repeat business, CVS boasted a customer retention rate in this last quarter of 97%, which is, again, excellent for the retail pharmacy industry. Now they have nearly 90 million plan members, a million of which are from their senior plan business, which we discussed in detail last year.
The company reported lower inflation on specialty drugs, which is very interesting because you see that contrast with those generics that I had talked about previously. From the retail side, the front end of the store, they saw less traffic but higher average basket, which is good in some fashion. But the store brands now represent 23.2% of all front-end products. So you can extrapolate and see that potentially this helps on margins on the front end, at least, even though those sales are coming down negative year over year. In the communities, they have helped to educate some people on the opioid crisis. So again, another positive PR thing to highlight here from the earnings transcript. They claim to have helped and educate over 300,000 students throughout the United States this past year. That's very interesting. And it is really interesting when you contrast that to other parts of their business they talked about in their Q&A section of their earnings call. What you don't hear management shedding light on is proper diets and preventative medicine. Yet they talked about the 30 million people with diabetes and how, and I quote, they call this a trend driver. The CDC came out with a study earlier this summer as I was doing some research. They highlighted that 100 million people inside the United States, so roughly 30% of the U.S. population, are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. These are just objective facts. This is a huge opportunity for them and all the pharmacy benefit managers in the space. At an average cost for a type 2 diabetes patient, it's around $14,000 a year. You're including medications and maintenance. In fact, like I said, they call this a trend driver, but they are saying that they can actually lower costs because of being able to have more vertically integrated business operations and really lower the cost for medications long-term for their customers. However, again, there is little talk about prevention here, just monitoring and mentoring the patients as it pertains to symptom management. So I think this is very interesting because they're talking about the opioid crisis, but here they're talking about the opportunity to extract long-term revenue from an increasing population that has diabetes, a lot of which could be prevented with proper diet. They talked about their real estate program during the quarter. The company opened 56 new locations, closed 5, relocated 5. And what is interesting is they did highlight the fact that this is a program. They're always going through their real estate portfolio, something that's thematic for us here on the Retail Focus podcast as we talk about commercial real estate a lot. The company is always looking at their overall portfolio, now 9,751 stores globally in 49 states, Puerto Rico, and a few locations in Brazil. They're taking a $220 million hit as a result of closing almost 70 locations. That's what they're on track to close this year. They're talking about broken lease agreements, which obviously you have to usually pay the remaining balance if you close out prematurely. As for that forward guidance, they narrowed GAAP earnings per share and raised adjusted earnings per share for the full year. They confirmed their cash flow estimates at around $7.7 billion to $8.6 billion in total. For those shareholders or potential shareholders, Analyst Day is coming up very soon, within a month or so, on December 12th. As for their shares, the share price remained unchanged overall this week. There was a brief dip after earnings, but shares remained around $69-$70 throughout the rest of the week. Shares at the beginning of the calendar year were around $80. They carry right now a $70 billion market cap with a price-to-earnings ratio of around 14.2.
We move on to our second news story for this segment of the Retail Focus podcast, and we're talking about Crocs here, the shoewear company. Still plugging away at it, but shares have dropped yet again after their third quarter results and guidance. This despite the fact that the earnings report, not all that bad for Crocs. The company is known more for its clogs shoe that rose to prominence about a decade ago. Since then, it's become a little bit maligned in the media, especially fashion media, but they also have flip-flops and sandals. Their typical store footprint includes specialty footwear and family footwear, as well as footwear for those at work. And that's really where you saw popularity driven for Crocs back about a decade ago, as a lot of nurses, a lot of other employees that had to remain on their feet for long periods of time were getting assistance from the Crocs, whether they be the clogs or other forms of shoes that they offered. Shares being down here is mostly a function of poor guidance for the rest of the year and not necessarily the third quarter results, because as we talked about, the third quarter results were fairly good. Let's take a look at the financials. Their revenue for the third quarter was $243.27 million, which is down less than 1% year over year. Now, it is still down, but just not down as much as analysts believed it would be, as the revenue beat the estimates by about $6 million. That's a hefty percentage on that estimate beat. Again, $6 million in total revenue of $243 million. Top line revenue included a $1.3 million benefit from currency translation as well, something we haven't seen a lot of in recent past, because currency translations have done more hurting of companies' bottom lines than they've done helping companies' bottom lines. The company blames much of the decrease in revenue, that less than 1% decrease, on having fewer physical stores and changes to their business model. We agree that probably having less physical stores is a good thing. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the story. Retail store sales fell 7.2%, but same store sales were up marginally 0.4%. So that falling of 7.2% is reflective of their store closures, not of same store sales, which, you know, up 0.4%, but just slightly better than stagnant. Direct-to-consumer channels increased 7%, and wholesale saw a modest 2% bump. For the company, earnings per share came into the negative figure, around 3 cents per share to be exact. However, the loss much more narrowed versus last year's loss of 7 cents per share. Analysts expected a 5 cents per share loss this quarter, so they beat by about 2 cents per share. This means, when you take it all into consideration, although they're earning less revenue, they're being more efficient while doing so, and part of that is because they're closing their retail stores, they're getting rid of that overhead, and they're getting rid of those high rents. A 50.8% gross margin with a 100% basis point increase on that margin year over year kind of bears all of that out. And what's more, they have less inventory on the balance sheet too, with $29.1 million less in inventory this quarter over the previous year's quarter.
This is a company we've only talked about, I believe, once in the past, and it's a company that Trent and I talk about when we're not doing the podcast, because this is a company that has taken a lot of losses and has really failed to adjust its business model, but is now doing so. And as you can see, they're now taking one-time charges as a result of structural changes made from within. Andrew Rees, Crocs CEO, made several intriguing statements on Tuesday with analysts. The company is on track to cut between $75 million and $85 million annually, and they want to deliver between $30 and $35 million in income from operations in 2019. So I talk about these structural changes. Obviously, there's going to be an end goal in place. The end goal is to be profitable once again. The company is still focused on the clogs, which is a little interesting to us, but also sandals, flip-flops, and slides. They are continually marketing new products through all of their three distribution channels. And if you go to their website, Trent, it's very interesting because the website really hasn't changed over the last couple of years or so. It's still the same basic format. It is pretty logical in setup, and this is something we'll talk about a little bit later, but clogs is certainly something they look to promote on there. And you really have to wonder if you're a shareholder, a longtime shareholder, are they going to be innovating within that particular segment more than just how they have been in the recent past? New styles, colors, and graphics that they've talked about, and licensed embellishments where they feel like they can improve on brand loyalty through their customer base. Is this enough? This is something I really wanted to highlight for Crocs. This is something they've talked about for years now, and this is something they've obviously been known for. They have flashy colors with everything they have as far as their product portfolio is concerned. But is this going to be enough for sustainability? We talk about those massive gross margins. That's a very positive thing. But if you really are going to see a continued customer base that's interested in your brand, you're going to have to be fresh and you're going to have to deliver something that's going to be sending a lot of positive messages. And I just don't think that all of these new styles and colors they're emphasizing going to necessarily do the trick. The company distributes obviously through e-commerce and wholesale, but also with their retail footprint, which, as Trent acknowledged, is going to be reduced with time. And this is something that got a lot of criticism about 4 to 5 years ago. A lot of analysts were saying potentially they're growing too fast, particularly globally. They were in these high rent locations, very expensive to the bottom line, but the executives were very bullish on the concept and they wanted to get their brand out there. They wanted people to acknowledge them as a leader in the space. As a breakdown of revenue, sandals now represent 18.6% of sales. And this was interesting because last year only represented 13.8%. So you talk about growth opportunity. It's maybe not the styles and colors and graphics on their clogs. Perhaps it's sandals and innovating through that new market category. The company feels as though this is an opportunity to make even more progress in this highly competitive market and space. They acknowledge the competition here is very robust. They had to have some markdowns in order to clear out some inventory, but they will have a new sandal called the Light Ride sandal in the spring and summer of 2018. And so this is an opportunity for us to discuss the innovation aspect, not necessarily the colors and things like that, but new proprietary materials overall. So this new Light Ride sandal is going to be obviously a little lighter, but also a little bit more comfortable on those feet. And that's very important for those who wear sandals all year round or live in parts of the country where you can do so. The company has less SKUs overall for their winter selection. Again, talking about that inventory, and Trent rightly talked about that reduction around $29 million or so for this latest quarter, but they said they wanted to clear out for the holiday season and looking more towards 2018 to push newer products. So they're really sort of restructuring the business so that they can focus on showing their customers that they have these newer products, market them in a correct way. The company completed an annual survey, they said, that saw customers responded in a positive way. More recently, as with those marketing materials, the company saw double-digit gains towards brand desirability, relevance, and consideration with certain niches in the market, and they feel like this is a direct tie-in to those said marketing efforts. They call this invaluable PR coverage, and this is interesting because you really haven't seen a lot, but if you go online, they have been boosting those ads online in the digital space, and that is actually where the company is transitioning towards to have a bigger revenue boost from e-commerce. An area where analysts were most interested in is international sales. I talked about their retail footprint internationally. The company posted low to mid single digit direct-to-consumer sales gains in Asia and European markets, but some falling retail sales as far as brick and mortar were concerned. Store closures have hit some markets particularly hard. Some markets they didn't expect to hit that hard as those numbers were coming in for the third quarter.
I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about some things that we could extrapolate from Crocs' recent performance. in particular having to do with their brick and mortar expansion. And looking back, not even 10 years ago, even 6 to 7 years ago, we believe that their expansion of brick and mortar, although we're still very bullish on brick and mortar overall for especially a company like Crocs, we did feel like they expanded this perhaps too quickly. It could have stayed more direct to consumer and exclusive wholesale with just a few metro corporate flagship locations, or oftentimes we talk about outlet mall sales being robust for certain companies, particularly at the premium outlet malls. That's something that Crocs could have used to their benefit as well. But since we can't go back in time, the company going forward, it seems as though they know the path back to profitability and a sustaining business model. And we've seen that through a drive back towards zero over the last couple of years. Still innovating, which is important for the brand, especially given how long their products last. So unless you're innovating, unless you're churning out new products, there's not going to be that onus there for the consumer to go back to a Crocs store and purchase a new product, in part because Crocs shoes last forever. I remember I bought a pair of the clogs about 11 to 12 years ago. Still have that same pair, and that pair of clogs still works as well as what it did on day one. So this is a circumstance here very much like kind of a smoke detector industry, if you will, in that smoke detectors will work for a long period in time, and you have to find a way to bring customers back because otherwise you've essentially saturated the market. That innovation is so crucial for them. But still, their brand, as much as they talk about their brand, it does seem diminished when looking back 4 to 5 years, especially among younger people. When you look at brand awareness among particularly college students, they've taken a little bit of a hit in terms of how well that brand is regarded. In terms of their website, still functioning, still logical, but could be reorganized a bit to show the direct-to-consumer advantages like free shipping for any orders over $24.99, which is going to be most orders on their website, and also easy returns. But these items are actually at the bottom of the page, and considering how much customers are looking for free shipping nowadays, particularly with Walmart's push to make people more aware of their own free shipping services, this is a bandwagon that Crocs could certainly be well served to jump on. And more investment in terms of their website and the functionality is probably needed, since that's where even they say their customer is going, and we've seen an increase in direct-to-consumer sales via e-commerce. They could also streamline their overall image as well to make it clear that they are the one and only Crocs brand, not a knockoff imposter. And in fact, when you look at their brand and their particular shoes, some of the interesting things about the Crocs brand is they do have a lot of imposters, they do have a lot of knockoffs, but these knockoffs are really only covered on an investor relations page, which is something that Leighton and I might look at, but most of their customers probably won't. Now, in terms of guidance, as we mentioned earlier, their full year outlook for Crocs in 2017 did not help the share price, despite the fact that they beat on earnings in this past quarter. Crocs is looking at revenues down low single digits compared to 2016 top line revenue, but what's perhaps most interesting here is the fact that revenue is down sequentially year over year, as it was down in 2016 as well, 5% from 2015. So again, continued store closures going to drive that top line revenue down. The question is, can they be more efficient on the revenue they are bringing in? Let's look at the share price very quickly. They're down as of earlier this week, close to 9% after the earnings call. However, the company is down almost 30% year to date, thanks to some built-in pessimism there. And perhaps what investors see is a lack of long-term strategy. I think we're a little bit more optimistic for the company as we see that strategy beginning to turn around and beginning to materialize to the customer. Crocs does have a market cap of $715 million. Obviously a negative price to earnings ratio since they did post a loss in this last quarter. From a share price perspective, the company really hasn't done anything substantial for the last 7 years. After their IPO, the company swung from around $13 per share to around $66 per share within a year's time. But since that point, they've struggled to keep up in a changing market, a lot more consumer channels in digital. And as such, you see the share price under $10 or in and around the $10 mark where it's at today. When we return, we're going to turn our attention to e-commerce and the back end of e-commerce in reference to marketing e-commerce and also analytics e-commerce with a representative from the company, Zayas. mentioned it at the top of the show, but there are a lot of perks that come with owning your own business. These are perks that Leighton and I have taken advantage of in the past or currently take advantage of, like having more control of your time, for example. But if you don't own your own business, you might be unsure of where to start. Potentially, though, Leighton, numbers suggest that owning a UPS store franchise would be a good place.
Yeah, it may be a little bit scary to start a business from scratch, so why not do one that's already been proven out? The concept is there, and the UPS store brings in over 35 years of franchising experience. They were actually just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. They bring in stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and that proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll ever need. And stores, Trent, are available in both large and small markets, so there's really no excuse. Get with the UPS store now.
They also have special financing for those who qualify and programs for military veterans. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. We continue our shop.org interview series brought to you by gainloans.com, and we're joined now by the VP of Marketing for Zayas, Eric Keating. And to begin with here, before we launch into some of the more particulars about what it is that Zayas does and the ways in which you help retailers, you know, most e-commerce related businesses, whether it's an e-commerce business itself or someone that's serving e-commerce behind the scenes, start with a problem. Right? And there's a problem that exists and you look to solve it. So what problem was it that Zayas was looking to solve when they got started up?
Yeah. So thanks for having me on, Trent and Leighton. Appreciate it. So the problem that many problems that we solve, but at its core, the problem that we solve is e-commerce companies, they're just dealing with more and more channels. Their customers are dealing with more channels and more devices by which to engage with the brands. And as a result, really, that's led to a very fragmented view of who your customers are. So being able to understand your customers better and then quickly leverage that data to better personalize your communications, segment your customers, et cetera, that's really the core problem that we solve, is giving you that holistic view of your customers.
So really does seem like a overall customer-centric company, a company that's focused on the customer. Can you speak to the relationships that you've built and cultivated over time and how it's really important to have all of those services under one umbrella?
Yeah, so I think the most simple way to answer that is because our technology unifies all of your customer interactions across channels and devices, and the core of the technology is really identity resolution. So being able to tell that, you know, Trent on his mobile device is the same Trent on his desktop at home, is the same Trent on his desktop at work, is the same Trent that opens emails, right? So having all of that unified and really boiled down to a single view, that's going to give you a complete picture of your customer and enable you to engage with them in a more personal, high-touch kind of way. So that's what really is at the core of what helps our customers engage their customers better, develop stronger brand relationships and loyalty over time. You know, that is obviously very important, especially with how competitive e-commerce has become. There are, you know, millions of e-commerce websites out there, and consumers have more options than they've ever had. So, you know, people are dropping prices, discounting, et cetera, and the only way to combat that and not go down this rabbit hole of continually discounting is to develop strong brand relationships. Develop a relationship with your customer that makes them want to come back and buy from you. And in order to do that, you've got to treat them in a personal way. Your customers are sick of getting the same email as everybody else, or the same, you know, any type of communication as everybody else. They want something that feels personal, and that's how you develop relationships. So because we play that role with our customers, they value our technology quite a bit. And we've got customers up in the enterprise like Sotheby's and Scott's, and we've got customers down to, you know, upper SMB that are all having success with the platform.
Now, one of the things I like about it is you mentioned that your customers, once they garner this data in about who their customers are, what they prefer, they can go above and beyond just bulk discounting, because that's one of the things that makes an e-commerce business unprofitable, right? Is you just cut prices and cut prices and cut prices. So that being said, what are some of the things that your customer base is doing with this data in order to communicate in a more efficient way with the customer?
So there are many examples, and they span a pretty broad spectrum, but I'll just call out a couple, right? So the first, being able to identify that a customer using different devices is the same person. So here's an example of how that makes communication better. So if I'm browsing product on my mobile phone and, you know, I add something to my shopping cart, let's say. This is a very, very basic example. I don't buy it. I go home. I use my desktop. I end up purchasing that product. As a brand, if you're not able to tell that's the same person, I might end up sending, you know, the person who did the browsing on their mobile device an abandoned cart email or not understand that they eventually purchased that product. That's very basic, but you know, being able to do that is going to guarantee more relevant information. Segmentation, really important. So if you have a big sale coming up, let's say you're selling apparel and you have a big sale on pants and you know that there are certain customers in your entire customer base that tend to purchase and browse pants. Now you can start to say, all right, well, my pants sale is Friday, my shirt sale is Monday. I'm not going to send two emails and blast everybody with the same content. I'm going to send the pants email to people who have shown a propensity to buy pants. I'm going to send the shirts email to people who have shown interest in shirts. And so that's segmentation. That's all based on browsing behavior and purchase behavior. So that's another way that that type of information helps.
So we're here at shop.org, and obviously almost every booth is talking about some new innovation that they're offering on their platform. Is there anything that you're personally excited about, given the history and the success of the company thus far, that you've introduced in a new way that people seem really excited about and up for?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a broad answer. I can get more specific, but having this data set at its core makes everything you do more intelligent and more effective. So while there are other companies out there that offer kind of solutions like, you know, product recommendations, for example, there are tons of companies that do that. But being able to do that based on the most holistic view of your customers' data is going to make them just that more effective. So when we introduce new features like that, which product recommendations is one that we've just recently introduced to our customers, that it's something that, while not entirely new, recommendations are not new to the industry. Being able to do it on this type of data set really is, and takes it to the next level. So, you know, anytime we introduce a new feature like that, it really is a new way of doing it. So that's what I get excited about.
One of the things that I've been interested in hearing is you've talked to people from a wide span of different businesses. And at Zayas, you guys have, in all likelihood, data sets from a vast array of businesses, of course. So I like asking if you guys have noticed, on the whole, any interesting trends in the data or any interesting things going on in e-commerce that might be flowing under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, the metric that is most interesting to us right now, and I'm not sure how under the radar it is, I think it's starting to become pretty widely accepted, is the vast majority of your customers will never make a second purchase from your brand, especially in some short period of time. So we generally say that on average, and it certainly depends on the type of business, but on average, 80% of your first-time buyers won't make a second purchase from you. You know, if you can increase that 20% to 25% or 30%, which our customers have done repeatedly, that's a massive opportunity for your business. And retaining existing customers and getting them to purchase again is pennies compared to what it costs to acquire a new customer. So as these new businesses are popping up, they're focusing a lot on acquisition, which from the beginning you really have to do. But once you've got a customer base, start investing in them, because the ROI there is just that. I mean, that's how you grow your business exponentially and do it at scale.
One last thing I'll ask too is kind of based on this concept. You know, a lot of people say what retail's about getting one more item or getting them to come back one more time. But in this case, really what a lot of e-commerce businesses are trying to do is create habitual consumption or habitual consumers, to where you constantly check a website, constantly go there for a particular product. So what are some ways in which, outside of that which you've already talked about, in which your customers could or are already trying to increase that habitual consumption, increase return rates to websites, if you will?
Beyond what I've already mentioned, and those are certainly important, automating lifecycle-based campaigns. So a couple examples, a post-purchase campaign that you can set up to automatically go out, you know, some period of time after somebody makes a purchase with recommendations. You know, maybe you're leveraging machine learning here, or kind of our out-of-the-box recommendations. Maybe you're looking at the data and saying, okay, well, I know that people who purchase product A first, as their first purchase, have a very high propensity to purchase product B or something from product category B as their second purchase. Now I can start leveraging that information to create more effective post-purchase campaigns. Another example, replenishment campaigns. So there are a lot of products out there now, like especially in, you know, vitamins and those types of products, but even to running shoes that have a certain number of miles on them, right? Once you understand what that buying cycle is, you can start to implement replenishment campaigns that say, okay, well, somebody bought a a bottle of 60 vitamins in 2 months from now, they're likely to buy again. Let's say 45 days, I'm going to send them a reminder with a discount on it or something like that, right? And all of this, based on the information you have and the ability to automate campaigns against it, you know, that all becomes very easy.
All right, Eric Keating with Zaius. Thank you so much for joining us today at shop.org.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we pick back up with the news portion of the Retail Focus podcast with HSN. Now, we don't talk a lot about television shopping channels here because a lot of those are seen as a little bit antiquated. However, HSN, as we'll find out in this earnings report, more than just the television shopping network that you know and remember. They reported their third quarter earnings on Wednesday, and the company missed profit and revenue marks, but shares were up 8% in trading on Thursday, almost a reverse instance of where Crocs was at, as we talked about earlier in the show. For those that may not be familiar with HSN, they offer third-party merchandise directly to consumers through basically omni-channel platforms. They have the famous television home shopping program broadcast on HSN television networks and other direct response television marketing. They also have catalogs and, of course, a website. Their main competitor coming into this year was Liberty Interactive, the company that owns QVC, and Liberty is looking to close the acquisition of HSN in short order. So this is probably one of, if not the last HSN earnings call that we'll be able to talk about. In fact, back in July of this year, they mentioned a $2.1 billion price tag for HSN, did Liberty Interactive. That's being done in stock and not cash. It encompasses the roughly 61% of HSN that Liberty Interactive did not already own. They actually had a previous stake in the company, but they felt like HSN could expand their viewership and customer base on all platforms, including the website. When we look at QVC, they did $8.7 billion in sales last year. HSN's revenue, much less than that, $3.5 billion. The combined QVC group going forward will include 5 business units, 8 global functions, so it is a very complex business. QVC last month declared that they will retain some but not all high-level executive appointments from HSN, so tapping into synergies in the form of streamlining the workforce. One final note regarding this merger before we get to the results with Layton is that HSNI incurred $1.3 million in external transaction costs related to the merger in the third quarter of 2017. This transaction, we should note, still subject to shareholder approval, expected to close in the fourth quarter of 2017. Originally, executives said the closing would take place somewhere in the last 3 months of the year, which did seem like a relatively rushed deadline for lawyers and accountants. We're probably going to see this deal finalized, although in the fourth quarter of 2017 is mentioned, probably in early January.
Yeah, and that's interesting because back in July, Trent, as you had mentioned, Liberty Interactive said they wanted to actually close on this during the last 3 months of the year, so October, November, December. I don't know necessarily if that's going to come to fruition, but you see that some potential holdups could be the financials, as they reported results that actually missed expectations here. GAAP net income fell 20% to $16.2 million. Again, this is an interesting dynamic here because HSN, they have been struggling as of late a little bit. And I think that's why QVC is interested in buying them as a competitor. You see that GAAP net income fell 20% to $16.2 million. And this is interesting because you've seen them struggling a little bit, but I think QVC has it in their right mind to actually consolidate in this space, try to bring some synergies together, as you remarked, not only through management, but through the product sourcing and everything to really bring out some cost savings in the long term. The specialty retailer reported adjusted earnings per share of 37 cents in the quarter, missing estimates there by around 7 cents per share, a 29% decrease year over year. HSN's operating income decreased also 11% to $32.9 million. Top line revenue of $782 million for the quarter. This compared to consensus estimates of $804 million. Revenue last year came in at $823 million. You really do see a business that is contracting in terms of sales and in terms of profit and margins. We look at potential reasons as to why the business got affected in their latest quarter, and you see that hurricanes, again, coming up on this edition of the podcast, as They affected the HSN business, a business that didn't necessarily have direct tie-ins to those hurricanes. If you look at a brick-and-mortar standpoint from CVS, for instance, they had to close down temporarily some locations, some permanent. HSN actually ended up having to close its headquarters in September and redeployed personnel and relocated its broadcast studios to temporary facilities outside of the storm's track. So one would think the production studios, well, you still need to do business. So you need to move those and you need to move those employees as well. And guess what? That costs money. Those actions resulted in an increased operating expense for the quarter and limited program effectiveness, which they estimated impacted net sales and adjusted earnings before taxes by about $13 million and $5 million respectively. If you look at some of the other highlights that were mentioned in their press release, is there was no formal conference call because the merger with QVC is expected to happen very soon. It's right around the corner. So in the last quarter, the second quarter, they did have a formal analyst call. That was probably going to be their last. Executives did blame, according to the press release, internal and external factors for the quarter's performance. We mentioned the hurricanes, but you look at the board of directors, they approved a quarterly cash dividend of 35 cents per share. So they're still looking at profitability in the long term. And you're saying that shareholders of record as of December 6th should get that 35 cent dividend. Shares in July after the proposed merger request from QVC shows really the share price being bumped up from $32 a share to $39 a share. But in recent months, there has been a lot of volatility within HSN. I don't know if there's been a lot of rumors of maybe not being able to close the deal through Liberty Interactive, but the stock price has actually gone up and down around $34, $35, $36 a share in the last couple of months. But as a result of this press release, this latest earnings call, shares actually popped around 3%. They're back to around that $39 a share mark, which means the deal is probably going to happen and there's less room for the share price to grow as of now. We mentioned the approved dividend for the company, and it currently, if you compare to the stock price, it's around 3.5% yield. So a fairly good yield for those shareholders there. Price to earnings ratio of around 18, which is still a fairly positive price to earnings ratio. And given the market, given all of those really robust multiples you're seeing, not just in retail, but other sectors of the market, obviously the Dow is at all-time highs right now, 18 is actually fairly reasonable for QVC coming in and buying them at a fairly decent price point. And this is our opinion, but we must remember that both sides are saying that this is subject to shareholder approval. However, we're sure that shareholders like the idea of potential network externalities brought forth by the much larger entity. And this is something that if you go through a lot of the notes by larger institutional investors, you don't see a lot of pushback. You don't see a lot of people saying that, well, this company would be a little bit more profitable, a little bit more sustainable long-term by itself. In fact, you're seeing more of the opposite, positive sentiment around this merger of these two parties.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look ahead to stories that we're watching for the next week or next month, and Leighton's looking towards the cloud.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm looking towards the cloud because this is something that's come up in the recent past. We talk about Amazon and Amazon Web Services being such a massive platform, being something that's really been a profit driver for the company to where they can actually reinvest that capital, redeploy that capital into their not-so-profitable retail side of the business. But as we come to find out, a lot of retailers are trying to pull back potential partnerships with Amazon because they find that almost as a conflict of interest, because you don't want to give them more money in the AWS platform only to compete with you further down the line in retail and take maybe some of your business down the line. So obviously, some of the retailers are looking at other partnerships with Microsoft, with Google, and you know, IBM also has a cloud networking platform as well. Kroger is looking to move to Microsoft and Google, and this came in the news by way of CNBC. And you look right now, you see statements by Kroger's chief information officer. He told CNBC in an interview, for obvious reasons, competitively, it does not make sense for them to do a ton of business with them, and they really don't want to help the growth. And so you're looking at Amazon's retail business, pushing into groceries with obviously with the Whole Foods merger, but talking about delivery, they've been delivering groceries for quite some time now. This is an interesting move for Kroger, as AWS is a pretty remarkable platform. A lot of people say that it's one of the most reliable platforms as far as cloud computing is concerned, but Microsoft is seeing a larger percentage of their revenue coming into cloud computing. I'm sure it's a very robust platform as well. Google, obviously a player in the space. This could be sort of a momentum swing. A lot of retailers could be, Kroger being one of the largest, but a lot of other smaller retailers could be taking some signs and signals from Kroger and thinking, when our contract's up, when our partnership's up with AWS, perhaps we could go to somebody else as well that is not thoroughly involved in retail and taking our market share down the line.
Well, I'm looking ahead towards earnings actually for this quarter that we're in currently, the fourth quarter for most retail stores, and particularly with Target and Best Buy. Target and Best Buy, very interesting strategies in regard to Black Friday, because Target, while they did release a series of Black Friday deals and they mentioned their hours over Thanksgiving, they're actually doing some weekend deals, or what they're calling weekend deals, in advance of Black Friday. This is one of the first times that we've seen a major retailer really roll out a distinct platform for the lead up to Black Friday. And what Target is doing is they're actually discounting a lot of kitchen goods. So they're banking on customers still making large meals for friends and family for Thanksgiving, trying to discount those kitchen goods that those friends and family might need. But Best Buy actually doing a similar thing, a lot of pre-Black Friday sales here, and this has caused a little bit of a domino effect. But because Target and Best Buy were some of the initial retailers to do this very thing, and because Target rolled out a variety of e-commerce deals through which they're attempting to attract customers, I wonder if Target's sales overall for this quarter is going to be larger than it was for last quarter, even if Black Friday sales are down, simply because they've been able to distribute the impact of Black Friday, but also they've been able to get a leg up on certain other retailers. Again, Walmart's been running ad campaigns regarding kitchen gear and regarding cooking gear overall, but Target has captured a lot of positive press, in particular with its weekend deals program. And so I'm looking ahead towards their next earnings call and wondering if this weekend deals thing could actually produce a significant boost to their top line. Now, the downside to it is if it works this year, you're going to see every retailer do it next year, and it's going to be a little less differentiated. But at least for now, Target sticking their neck out with some of those pre-Black Friday deals geared towards the kitchen. Next week on the Retail Focus podcast, we'll talk about JCPenney's earnings beat from this Friday, as well as other apparel news. Again, big thanks to Zayas for appearing on this week's show. For Layton, I'm Trent, and we'll say so long until next week. We'll have a Food Focus up early next week as well.
This has been the Retail Focus podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com. and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.